If it doesn't come from those made desperate by poverty, deprivation or injustice, if it is not simply a response to Western intervention in Iraq and Afghanistan, what is driving this hatred and terrorism in the name of Islam? Do we attempt to engage with it, or are its purposes beyond any kind of negotiation, an evil that can only be confronted and crushed? That's our Moral Maze tonight. Our panel, Melanie Phillips, social commentator on the Daily Mail, the Catholic writer Clifford Longley, the media guru Professor Ian Hargreaves, and Professor Stephen Rose, the biologist from the Open University. Clifford Longley, what's your instinct about this? Is this the kind of terrorism that that you can negotiate with?
No, I think we're dealing with a phenomenon that goes very profound and deep, and I think we're probably going to have to sit it out. It'd be important not to make the wrong moves, but there's not much we can do, frankly, to head it off.
Stephen Rose?
Well, your introduction suggested that it's not to do with British foreign policy, etc., 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 and I would question that very statement. I think one's got to look at the motivations behind these criminal acts, both in the outside world and in the individuals concerned.
The introduction actually poses as a question, Stephen. If it isn't, what is it? Melanie Phillips.
Well, I think that what we're facing is fundamentally a species of religious fanaticism which takes the form of a political ideology to Islamize the world and Islamize all unbelievers. And it's a non-negotiable position. And you can't engage with that. You can't seek to change those people's minds. There are some situations where you can engage with people who have had a violent past. This is not one of those situations.
Ian Hargreaves.
Well, we certainly won't successfully confront or crush the misguided and deeply evil ideas that lead to this kind of terrorism if we don't also engage with it. And also, if we don't engage with it on the basis of our own values, patiently, we will make the wrong moves.
Panel, thanks very much indeed. Our first witness is Shiv Malik, who's a journalist who spent 8 months investigating the July 7th bombings, currently writing a book on British terrorism. Shiv Malik, what in your view are they after? What do they want? What's behind this?
Well, I think, people have suggested that this might be related to foreign policy. I think very much it's an aggravating factor. And at the heart of this lies two things. First of all, I think you have a cultural dislocation between a first and a second generation. So, for example, when I did research on Mohammed Sadiq Khan, and you'll see the same factors in Omar Sharif, who was a bomber who went off to kill himself in Tel Aviv in 2003. You have these factors of basically them rebelling against their parents and their traditional culture in Pakistan. And very much of these values, mainstream society wouldn't support. For example, forced marriage, not educating women, and sort of a backward, sort of as it's known as the Baradri system, which is a very sort of communitarian way of going about things. And it doesn't really apply to society as you have it now in this country, but it does apply in Pakistan.
But as it manifests itself, apart from the generational dislocation, the cultural dislocation, to what extent is it driven by a particular interpretation of Islam?
Yeah, well, this is the second point. So you have the first point, which is kind of a push factor into all of this. And the second point is that it's at the heart of this is an ideology known as variously as Islamism or Wahhabism, Salafism. But I would like to term this, just to keep it simple, Islamism for the moment. And what this says is essentially this, that Islam and the state can't be separated, and it's an interpretation of looking at the Quran, which is fairly fundamentalist, which says, look, when it says, for example, cut the hand of the thief, we have to do this because this is what it says in the Quran, this is what God says. And we can't just do this individually. We need a state to enforce this punishment. And there's dozens of these rules and regulations which we need to enforce, which God is calling us to do. And so we need to fight for a state. And not only that, since God has also called on us to fight unbelievers, wherever we find them, we need to take over the world. And that's very basically what they say in a nutshell.
Stephen Rose.
Okay, let's just start with what you call the aggravating factor. That's a very interesting psychological profile of that particular group of bombers. But are you seriously suggesting that if the invasion of Iraq or Afghanistan hadn't occurred, if there was a just peace in the Middle East, then this sort of terrorist action, this criminal action would still be taking place?
Yes, absolutely.
In Britain?
Yes.
Why?
Well, for a start, if we look at the facts, take Mohammed Sadiq Khan, someone that we all obviously know being involved in July 7th bombings. Pretty case example. Now, for a long time, people have been going on and saying, look at the video. Look what he says in the video. He says, talks about, I'm a soldier fighting against you. Right, if you look at the rest of the video, so that minute and a half at the beginning is the bit that's replayed over and over again in the media. The rest of it, which is the video is 6 minutes and 21 seconds long, the rest of it, three quarters of it, is addressed to Muslims in Britain, and it's a theological battle.
Well, look, let's accept that all these things are going on, but I still find it surprising that we're prepared to run counter, for example, the analysis of RUSI, the Royal United Service Institute, and most other commentators who suggest that this has nothing to do with anything to do with external policies at all, and it's entirely going to be motivated, therefore, by theology.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying, look, it is an aggravating factor.
Okay.
And how that works, just to be precise on that, is Islamists in this country, for example, say, well, look at foreign policy, right, and look at this, and they'll use that to draw in and anger young Muslims. Abroad, in Muslim countries, for example, they'll use different factors to do the same thing.
Okay. Now, you've described a millenarian political and theological philosophy which believes in the literality of the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
How does that differ from Christian fundamentalists in the States who believe in the literality of the Bible and they should obey the biblical commands on killing doctors who are involved in abortion clinics, for example?
Well, I don't think it differs entirely in the sense that they're both fundamentalist, but there's two points to being fundamentalist. There's one about being literalist and there's one about being purist. And there's two different things which are often conflated, but they end up with very different results. So I would venture to say this much, that the majority of Muslims in the world say that that are basically literalist in the sense that they look at the Quran and they say that this is the word of God, right?
That's what the Christian fundamentalists do as well.
Yes, but
we can be very
honest. We're not actually being bombed by Christian fundamentalists, are we?
No, not in this country.
To what extent do you think, from your own investigations, are these people who can be dealt with, negotiated with, appeased?
Can they be negotiated and appeased? Well, no, I mean, I don't think it's a question of, well, first of all, we have to understand them. I don't think we've even got to the point where we really understand them yet. And, you know, there has to be a line drawn between empathy and sympathy. They sound the same, well, but they're entirely different. We do have to understand them, absolutely. I mean, someone asked me this before, and I said, look, it's like trying to fix a TV without understanding how it works. You know, you don't, you're bound to electrocute yourself if you go into it without the knowledge. So, first of all, we have to understand what this is about. And then that's what we do after that is just the matter.
You know, let's talk about what we do after that, because I agree with you that the causes here are complex. There's some politics, there's some religion, there's some sex, there's some culture, there's some generational strife. But Michael asked the question, should we confront and crush this rather than engage with it? What's your answer to that question?
Well, I think you can't. I mean, look, there's ideas, and then there's actions, and actions stem from ideas. In this case, for example, where we have jihadists, and you have people who say, okay, well, let's not be violent, but we hold the same ideas. Non-violent Islamist groups like Hizb ut-Tahrir. Now, in this country, certainly, we say, look, you can hold ideas, that's fine, and we're not going to lock you up for that, right? So we need, it's a multi-dimensional approach. I mean, it's not that complicated. I think you say, okay, right, we'll debate those ideas, like we did, for example, very much with the BNP, the National Front, and things like Combat 18, right? So we had different approaches to those, Combat 18 being largely a criminal group, and we locked them up. But then we tackled the ideas at the same time.
So your position, just to be clear, Vish, your writing, which has been very distinguished and illuminating in this area, is referred to and used by some people to say this is absolutely right, this is the kind of identification of the religious problem that's going on here, and it has to be attacked in an uncompromising manner. For example, you mentioned them by banning groups like Hizb ut-Tahrir, which is something which was considered by the British government and rejected on the grounds that there was insufficient evidence to take such an extreme step. Are you in favour of such a ban?
No, I'm not. I never have been. Though I must also state that there are people who've come out of those groups who have been in favour of banning Hizb ut-Tahrir. But my own personal view is that we should treat them no differently than, for example, the BNP. And we we shouldn't be afraid of debating our own values. If we really believe in what we believe, we shouldn't be afraid of having those debates and saying, come on, let's have this debate about, you know, Islam. And the only problem is that I think, you know, as a country, we're generally versed in Christian theology, and we're not versed in Islamic theology. And so those debates are difficult, but look, we should get involved in them.
So the kind of newspaper crusade, of which we've seen a bit again in the last few days, unsurprisingly, that says these preachers of hate should be silenced, referring to a certain section of the Islamic religious leadership in the UK, which I dislike as much as you do, but I'm not in favour of shutting their mouths down or forbidding them to speak. Are you?
Well, okay, when we say silence them, just to make clear, we're not saying obviously kill them or lock them up, and you're saying shut their mosques down. And well, look, the point about most radical preachers is they don't actually run mosques, and they run very little institutions.
Should they be prevented from preaching to the young and impressionable?
Well, look, we have laws on this, and if you encourage either racial hatred or encourage violence, then we have laws on that. And but in the meantime, what most of their debate takes place on is theological grounds. And I think that's a debate that we're better off getting involved in rather than shutting down at the moment.
I agree.
Can I just ask you, firstly, who is the we and how that debate is actually going to take place?
Well, the we, okay, this is a good point, I think, because, look, a lot of people say, okay, this is to do with Muslims and it's, essentially nothing to do with the rest of society. And by saying that as well, I think they're sort of inferring that this is separate from us. Look, we're one society, we've all decided to live together, and therefore, as a country, we should be able to say, look, this is obviously affecting the rest of the country, let's all get involved in this debate. So by we, I mean the whole of the country, Muslim or not.
Sheikh Malik, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Our second witness is Inyat Bunglawala, who's Assistant Secretary to the Muslim Council of Britain. Which has condemned the bombings in fairly robust terms in recent days. Inyat Bunglawala, do you agree that terrorism is, albeit aggravated by Iraq and Afghanistan and things, maybe even Salman Rushdie's knighthood and so on, but do you agree that this terrorism is fundamentally driven by an extremist interpretation of Islam?
I think there are a multiplicity of factors, and we shouldn't have to resort to speculation now. We have a number of cases, the Deir al-Barok case, the convictions of those involved in the Operation Crevice convictions, many cases now, and we have a substantial body of data. We should now be able to, based on the court transcripts, be able to make some tentative conclusions about why some young people are being drawn towards violent extremism. I think there are several factors involved. And
my question was, do you think that it is fundamentally driven by an extremist interpretation of Islam?
Not fundamentally. I think it's certainly a part of it. There's no doubt that those who engage in violent extremist acts are themselves convinced that they are doing something that's holy, that they don't believe that they're doing something unlawful. They believe that they will be rewarded for what they're doing. So it's certainly a part of the equation.
But there are other factors as well.
Yes.
Clifford Longley?
You're not denying the existence of the whole jihadi phenomenon, though.
No, I'm not. I do believe there are obviously people out there who believe it is their religious duty to engage in mass murder.
Well, really, who are the perpetrators of the 9/11 attacks on slaves? As the people who are signed up to a jihadist philosophy. All right, well, and that is a religiously motivated version of Islam.
It is a distorted version of Islam. Yes.
Well, who's to say so? There's no Pope in Islam, is there?
No, there isn't. But we have the vast, overwhelming majority of Muslims who disagree with that method. So it is.
So the majority decision. But they say the majority of Muslims are wrong and they're right. They've got this insight into the truth of Islam, and it requires them to engage in jihadism.
Well, that's their point of view. I mean, you've got to tackle.
Can I just turn to the question of the significance of Iraq and Afghanistan, which is often dragged into this argument? Isn't the truth that those are used to propagate the myth that the West is engaged in a crusade against Islam in order to draw volunteers into the opposite, namely a war on the West in the name of Islam?
No, I don't. I think the Iraq and Afghanistan wars clearly were regarded by many Muslims, perhaps the overwhelming majority of Muslims, as illegal invasions. And
so what? I mean, illegal things happen. Is that the basis on which jihadism becomes justified?
Well, it's certainly aggravating their cause, isn't it? It's certainly exacerbating the phenomenon. I mean, extremist ideas spread in certain times.
Okay, if it weren't for that, though, then it would be, as it was once before, Bosnia, then it would be Chechnya, then it would be Palestine. There is a list of grievances as long as you want. You can go on using.
No, Clifford, I think there is a difference in that Britain was not a target for extremist attacks by Muslims until very recently, and we need to question why. I think Stephen posed a very valid question to Shiv earlier. Why Britain? Why now? We did not see these attacks in the 1960s or the 70s or the 80s or the 90s. Why? Why in recent years?
Well, we saw the attack on America. There was no Iraq or Afghanistan or that.
No, but again, with America, there are long-standing hatred in parts of the Muslim world about its support for Israel. You can't deny it, that America's wholehearted support for Israel and its illegal settlements.
But that wasn't what 9/11 was about.
Well, how do you know?
Melanie, first.
Mr. Bungalala, you talk about what's driving this terrible thing, fundamentalism, as distorted view of Islam, as if it belongs to other people but not yourself. But you're an official of the Muslim Council of Britain, which was formed on the philosophy of Maulana Maududi, who said, quote...
That's false. What's your evidence that MCB was formed on the philosophy of Maulana
Maududi? The Islamic Foundation was a key constituent.
One affiliate out of over 400.
Well, let me put to you the quote by Maulana Maududi, and let's see what you think about it. The truth is that Islam is a revolutionary ideology which seeks to alter the social order of the entire world and rebuild it in conformity with its own tenets and ideals. Do you personally say that you do not agree with that?
Yes, I don't agree. I don't agree that if the implication is that you should forcefully bring the world to an Islamic order, I don't agree with that.
But you believe that it should be not forcefully brought to an Islamic order?
Of course, as a Muslim, I believe that the faith of Islam should be spread, and I engage in activities designed to spread the faith of Islam.
Okay, well, you yourself are on record many, many times of supporting Sheikh Qaradawi. Sheikh Qaradawi uses Islam as a theological justification for mass murder. He has said Europe will be conquered for Islam by preaching an ideology. His sermons regularly called for Jews to be killed. You have supported this man regularly. How can you then pose as a moderate?
Well, this way, Al-Qaradawi does not call on Europe to be converted forcefully. And that quotation there does not say Europe will be conquered forcefully.
It does not.
No, it says it is not force. It's the opposite of force. It is through ideas that Europe will come to Islam. And I think I'm very confident that the Islam will continue to spread in Europe.
He has said that Europe will be conquered for Islam by preaching and ideology. He wants Europe to be conquered. That's what I said. You appear to agree with that.
Well, I don't agree
with... You have supported this man who calls for the religiously mandated murder of children. He has said the Israelis might have nuclear bombs, but we have the children bomb. You have repeatedly supported this man. How can you pose as a moderate? You are an Islamist extremist in moderate clothing.
Melanie, I understand your deep attack to Israel clouds your view.
Could you answer this question?
I will answer it if you allow me to. Now, it's certainly true that Al-Qaradawi has views on Israel, which he has justified Hamas's use of the suicide bombing tactic. And his justification is, as long as Israel kills Palestinian civilians, then Hamas must be allowed to kill Israeli civilians in retaliation.
Let me put to you what Ed Hussein says in his book, The Islamist. He says that you took him to meetings of the Islamic Society of Britain, whose teachers were Hamas and Brotherhood ideologues, who imparted a deep and powerful hatred of Israel and the Jews. Quote, neither INIAT nor myself questioned any of this. Jew bashing was an acceptable part of the Islamist curriculum. And every week, says Hussein, Bungalala took him to such sessions of, quote, Quran recitation, religious discussion, anti-Semitism, and good food. You're a bigot, aren't you?
No, I'm not. In fact, in that book, he also accuses me of being conservative. I've never been a conservative in my life. The fact is, he's got it wrong. Certainly, in Islamic circles, there is a deep and abiding opposition to Israel. Of course there is, because the Palestinian people were displaced by the creation
of
Israel.
We're talking about hatred of
but
Jews.
But there's a difference between opposing Israel and opposing Jews.
And you support people who hate Jews.
You have no evidence of that.
I've just quoted you your own. I've just quoted that's you what people have
Melanie,
said.
Well,
you
saying let's move on. Clifford,
billions of pounds a year pour into British Muslim organisations from Saudi Wahhabi sources. Do they not? What do they get back for their money?
Well, I mean, Saudi Arabia, like other countries, will try and promote a teaching of Islam.
A Wahhabi interpretation.
They believe
it goes very well with the jihadist mentality.
Well, Saudi Arabia is a wealthy country, and it will use its wealth to spread its interpretation of Islam, as will other countries. Iran will try and spread its interpretation of Islam.
They're spreading jihadism. You're more or less agreeing. The purpose of this enormous flow of money into Britain, to British Muslim organisations, is to perpetuate this jihadist mindset.
No, I don't accept that. I don't accept the Saudi government is involved in spreading jihadism.
No, Wahhabi sources, not necessarily Saudi government, but Saudi.
And I need evidence for that.
Stephen Rose, quick question indeed. Shiv Malik said we need to start a debate to understand the extremists. What is the Muslim Council of Britain doing in order to foster that?
Foster a debate about what, sorry?
Foster a debate with the with those elements within the Islamic community who are actually sort of preaching and actually practicing criminal acts such as the ones we've just seen.
Oh, well, if anyone's preaching criminal acts and engaging in criminal acts, we have the law to deal with that.
Yeah, but what are you doing about a debate, which is exactly what Shiv Malik was calling
Well,
about?
Our problem is that most Muslims will not know an extremist. They will not know someone who is advocating violence. Now, if they do, we've made it very clear that they ought to be going to the police. They ought to be given the fullest cooperation to prevent any terrorist act in this country. Now, of course, our aim should be that if anyone has a grievance, political grievance against the war in Iraq or wherever, they should be articulating those grievances to the political mainstream.
I put it to you that you're actually abrogating your responsibility as the Muslim Council of Britain in this respect.
That's not true. And in fact, even this Saturday, we've called a meeting of key imams and community activists to see what possibly more we can do to draw young people away from the fanatical path.
Inayat Bangalwala, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Our next witness is Lord Alderdice, John Alderdice, who's in a Belfast studio. He was, of course, the leader of the Alliance Party in Northern Ireland for a decade or more, and now engages with the psychology of terrorism and political conflict in various different parts of the world, including the Middle East. Lord Alderdice, does expediency trump morality in dealing with terrorism? Do we have to engage with them, even though what they do is evil and wrong?
It's a difficult question. It's the kind of question that doctors often face when they're dealing with very difficult circumstances because, of course, morality isn't entirely a simple business. For example, if you say, well, here are people who engage in criminal activities, like the IRA, like loyalist paramilitaries in Northern Ireland, and after a very long period of time, the military starts to say to us, well, there's no military solution to this problem. You're going to have to find some kind of way of engaging with it. Then the dilemma you have is that you either hold to one set of principles, which says you don't engage with anybody who's breaking the law, or there is another set of moral principles which say that you don't continue to do something which you know isn't going to work, and not venture with some element of risk into another process which might bring some kind of peace. So there's a question as to whether you continue with an approach which doesn't work and whether that's a good moral principle or whether you try to engage in another way which may be successful.
I understand. Melanie Phillips, your witness.
I understand where you're coming from vis-a-vis Ireland, but do you accept that there are other circumstances where engagement may be very inappropriate? After all, a united Ireland as a goal is not the same as wiping an entire country off the map or Islamising the world. And after all, the IRA was militarily, at the very least, beaten into a kind of unwinnable situation. So do you accept there are some people whose agendas simply cannot be negotiated?
Well, if the question is, are there some circumstances where talking is not necessarily successful or maybe even the appropriate thing to do? Yes, I'm sure you're right. What I found myself doing after our experience, and I have to tell you that people here don't believe that the IRA was beaten into a corner. There are people who would say that actually the British Army couldn't win either. But the point was that for a long time, many people, including myself, said, well, we're not going to talk to these people. They're breaking the law. They're criminals. This is terrible altogether. Not going to engage with them. Until eventually we got to the point of saying, well, if there's any chance of taking it forward, we should do that. So after a number of years of this and finding some success, maybe more than we expected, I started to visit other parts of the world to see if the phenomenon which I was observing were unique to the Northern Ireland situation or whether there were elements of it elsewhere. And I found that, yes, there were things that were unique to ours, but there were other elements that were common.
Right. But does that mean that you would engage with absolutely anybody? I mean, for example, would you engage and seek to change the minds of the leadership of Al-Qaeda, in a different part of the universe, white supremacists, or in historical terms, Hitler?
Well, it depends whether or not you've any reason to believe that what you're doing is helpful or whether it might be counterproductive. And that's, of course, a matter of judgment. I started to engage with some of these people to see, was there any possibility? Because I felt that there was little evidence that the situation was improving in terms of security for Israel, or in terms of a betterment of the situation of Palestinian people,
yeah,
or better relationships in our wider world. And when I engaged with them, I found that it's not purely an intellectual or theological or even political business.
Mm-hmm.
There are powerful emotions that are involved, people feeling frightened and humiliated on both sides.
Undoubtedly.
And that's where the hatred comes from.
Undoubtedly.
It doesn't come from theology.
Undoubtedly, but isn't there an enormous danger that in certain circumstances, if you're, for example, talking to people with what I would consider to be non-negotiable positions, such as Hamas or Hezbollah, engagement turns into appeasement? You are on the board of an organization called Conflict Forum, which I think is what you're referring to in promoting engagement and dialogue with extremist organizations. But the slogan of your organization, Conflict Forum, is listening to political Islam, recognizing resistance. Now, doesn't that come dangerously close, recognizing resistance, to legitimizing terrorism?
Well, first of all, I'm involved with a large number of organizations, and I give advice to Conflicts Forum and to many other organizations as well. I try to find ways in which I can engage with people. Secondly, in terms of engaging with Hamas and indeed with Hezbollah, the work I'm trying to do is to persuade them to find another way, a better way, of working with the deep differences and divisions that there are in that part of the world, and indeed engaging with Israelis to try to see if there is a way that they too can find better security and a different way, because it's quite clear that neither side believes that what is happening at the moment is in the best interests of them or their people. And what's interesting is that there is a preparedness to explore these things if we give it a chance. Appeasement, of course, would be where one would be offering things in exchange for people withdrawing political positions.
Yeah, and
Lord Alderdice, you've specialised in the study of the psychology of terrorists. Isn't the shame and humiliation you've said you encounter among Muslim terrorists and other Muslims caused by internal Muslim failure, where Muslim states are outshone by non-Muslim states in the West in their efficiency, prosperity and human rights?
There's no doubt that that is one aspect of it, and I would go further and say that one of the other areas which is deeply offensive to some of these people is the way that some of the regimes in the Middle East, which are allies of the West, have not been great examples of democracy, human rights, or equality in terms of wealth and the economy, or in terms of how people are treated. And they look at us, in some cases, as people who sustain regimes which do not hold to the values we would ourselves proclaim as being important.
So can we stay for a moment with the theological point? Is it not true that a Muslim would believe that Allah wants the world to be ruled according to his laws? And the fact that that hasn't happened surely indicates that something in the system has prevented it, and they would regard that as a satanic influence and associate with that Satanism anything, including the West, including America, that stood in their way.
That's exactly what Christians believe too, and I know.
But is it not true? I mean, let us not sort of make disparaging remarks about Christians.
Of course it's true. I'm not making disparaging remarks. I am a Christian, and I've grown up in a Christian community, and I know very well what people believe. But fundamentalism itself does not create terrorists on its own. This is what I was saying earlier on. The notion that it's all about people believing things mixed and turned to violence to implement them is a deeply mistaken view. There are many people in the United States who hold to similarly fundamentalist beliefs, but that doesn't turn them into terrorists and it doesn't make them violent. The same is true for Muslims and for Hindus and for Jews and for others who do not have a religious faith. The fact that you have a fundamentalist belief does not of itself turn you into a violent terrorist.
Lord Alderdice, thank you very much indeed. Our last witness is Leo McKinstry, who's a Belfast-born author and columnist who's on the line from France. Leo McKinstry, should we try to understand terrorists, do you think?
Well, I think, as Melanie said, the great danger with trying to understand and talk about engagement is it so often slides into appeasement and even justification for terrorism. And I don't think that the radical Islamic agenda has any elements that we can negotiate with. I mean, I personally feel that we've got to defeat these terrorists by military force and by intelligence. Negotiating with them, engaging with them, gives the impression that we are weak, and it also somehow implies that there's some justification for their grievances. I actually don't think that there is such a thing really as Muslim grievance. It's a sort of sense of sorrow that they haven't imposed certainly for radical Muslims, they haven't imposed their ideology on the Western world, and that's their real grievance, that we haven't surrendered yet.
Ian Hodges?
Does your moral repugnance about the way that some people think that we should respond to Islamic terrorism reflect the same view that you took about negotiating with, treating with, dealing with terrorism in Northern Ireland and about Northern Ireland?
Well, I take a different view from a lot of people about terrorism in Northern Ireland. I grew up in the Troubles there, and during the early 70s, there were a lot of attempts. Willie Whitelaw, the Secretary of State, led perhaps the most famous one to negotiate with the IRA, and it didn't lead anywhere. In fact, there was a vast increase in terrorist activity and murders around Northern Ireland. And I actually think that from the late 70s, the British pursued a heroic agenda to militarily defeat the IRA, and by the late 80s, they basically achieved that. The IRA was riddled with informers.
Oh, we seem to have lost the line. Oh, there you are.
Enemy. And basically, the peace process was the IRA declaring a ceasefire and then negotiating for its own surrender.
But your view throughout, I believe, was that negotiation with Sinn Féin, with any elements within the Republican movement that were available for political conversation, was morally wrong. That's your position, isn't it?
Well, my position was that you have to defeat terrorists before you can negotiate with them. If they're actually armed, they've got a gun to your head, and they have a form of moral blackmail against you, and you can't negotiate with that. You have to beat them, and that's what happened in Northern Ireland. People don't like admitting it, but the IRA were defeated by the British Army, often in ruthless ways that we don't like, but the consequences are wonderful for Northern Ireland now.
You presumably also, therefore, still regard men like Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness as essentially criminals.
Well, the thing about the IRA is they did surrender. They actually said in 1994 the armed struggle's over.
So do you regard it as...
You know, it's 13 years on... In some ways, I admire Gerry Adams for forcing the IRA to face up to its military defeat and say, we've got to go down an alternative route. And Adams in prison now.
So you are morally comfortable with the idea and the fact that Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness are now senior ministers in the government of the devolved.
I'm not uncomfortable with it. I think Northern Ireland's a great success story, we can't talk about the British military success, but they did. They played a huge part in bringing this about. If Al Qaeda said tomorrow, the armed struggle's over, we're going to allow Western people to live in peace, we're not going to start, there won't be any more tribal conflict in Iraq, we're going to allow the State of Israel to exist, we're not going to march against Salman Rushdie's knighthood, we're not going to kill people in Chechnya, the armed struggle's over, we accept the peaceful coexistence, and maybe 10 years on down the line, you know, it might be okay to have peace, but there's not a sign that Al Qaeda is in that game at all. They want the destruction of our civilization.
Stephen Rose, last question.
They might equally argue that you want the destruction of their civilization.
Al Qaeda game, aren't you?
No, I'm actually trying to ask you a question. The question is this: if there is a war on, as you see it, between Al Qaeda, between Islamism and the West, is it not appropriate to try to understand your enemy? You said it's wrong to try to understand terrorists.
I said it was wrong to engage with terrorists, as if there was any justification for their grievances, as if understanding them means that you think that there's some legitimacy for their actions. There's no legitimacy for Al Qaeda's actions or for terrorists from radical Islam. Our only response can be to actually defeat it. What would be the end of trying to understand understand the Al-Qaeda and the radical terrorists in the sense of any political negotiations. What would be negotiating about? Which part of Western civilization?
Leo McKinstry cut off in midstream, I think. Leo, if you can hear me otherwise, I'm going to have to draw that to a close. Sorry, you lost just the last couple of seconds there, Leo, but we got what you were saying. Thank you very much indeed. He had a point, didn't he, Stephen Rose?
Well, he had a point that you actually he says there is a war on and there's no negotiation until one side or the other has won. This seems to me to be exactly what Melanie was quoting the Islamists are saying as well. If we actually think there's a war on like that, if we don't think there are grievances on both sides, if we don't think there are issues that can be resolved, then there's a fight to the death on. I think that's a highly regrettable situation, and I would like not to actually think that. I actually suspect that we do need to understand what's going on in order to actually deal with it.
But there is a difference between understanding. Mm-hmm. I mean,
To understand,
what we're actually talking about here is the morality of some form of engagement,
yeah.
And by engagement we actually mean negotiation.
Yeah.
And when Leo McKinstry says, what do we agree to negotiate about? It's rather an unanswerable question.
Yes, I think there is no answer to that question because their position is non-negotiable by definition, and that's the nature of a theocratic institution. It's got an absolute view. It wants the world to be organised in a certain way, and it's not prepared to consider any other way of doing it. That's as unnegotiable as it gets.
Yeah, but the mistake is to go from that comment to the argument that therefore the correct response to that is to abandon any hope of or expectation of understanding.
I wouldn't, the
people and the communities who have become involved in this kind of terrorism.
No, you're attributing to me a view I don't actually hold. I do think
I wasn't attributing the view.
We have to make the effort to understand in order to make sure we don't make it worse, which is very easy to do.
Yeah.
But we also have to meet the imprecision of the indiscriminate violence of terrorism with a precise response, not a generalized response, which actually by using words like Islamism runs the risk of indiscriminately describing and blaming very, very large numbers of people for what is actually a problem located in very specific subsets of
that. One of the things that's so remarkable about this general discussion that we all got to understand, and I do very much agree we do have to understand, is that the people saying we have to understand refuse to understand what is there to be understood, which is that this is fundamentally a war of religion, a politicized form of religion. We know that because that's what the people who are perpetrating this war against us say. They invite us to read what they say. Those of us who do read what they say do understand or are beginning to understand what they are saying.
People like you, Ian, who don't want to actually grasp
what they're saying.
I've read what they've said and what they do say as closely as you've read it, but I reach a different conclusion, which is that our response needs to be careful, thoughtful, not panic-stricken, not random in the violence that it dishes out. And it certainly shouldn't step away from the values that we're seeking to defend.
No one is saying that we shouldn't do that. But what we're saying is that instead of engaging, and engaging means negotiating and seeking to change people's minds, and it really is a very similar discussion that we're having or debate that we had in this country in the 1930s when we were faced with a non-negotiable situation
let's try and distinguish between we're talking about criminal acts of terror bombing in Britain, and there is no way of actually negotiating with the criminal act. That's a criminal act, it needs to be tried accordingly. That is very different from talking about the general issue of where the grievances which Mr. McKinstry denies exist between Islamic states and the West exist, and trying to understand where those causes are coming from and handle them. And just one reference, Clifford, there are several theocratic states in the world, including Israel, and they're not all necessarily
therefore
marriage inherent. Well, indeed. But Clifford was arguing that his theocratic state actually sort of was trying to advance the theocracy by force across the world.
Just moving this, Alderdice made an interesting point, I thought, where he said that this hatred comes from emotions rather than theology. emotions, I presume he meant shame, humiliation, inferiority,
complexity. I'm pushing what he said a bit hard. I think he said it's a component there.
Yeah.
And it's a very potent mixture, of course. Politics, religion and emotion.
But do you think he had a point?
Yes, absolutely. Politics, religion and emotion is the cause of most of the trouble in the world.
But what he doesn't take into account is the emotion that is inspired in generations of people who from the cradle are taught to hate on the basis of lies. They are taught, for example, that the Jews are a cosmic conspiracy against the world, against God. They're taught that the West is a conspiracy against Islam. Of course that inspires emotion. It inspires the emotion of hysteria, it inspires the emotion of hatred, and it inspires violence. And I'm afraid Lord Alderdice, I'm sure, is extremely well-meaning, but I'm afraid he is dangerously naive, because if you seek to negotiate and treat with people who are driven by irrationality, then you end up being played by them.
Without people like John Alderdice, the component of achieving a sustainable political peace in Northern Ireland would have been unachievable. There were many people throughout the Irish Troubles who argued about that precisely as you are arguing now about the Islamic terrorist issue. And those people, Leo McKinstry was one of them, were wrong then, and they're wrong now.
Well,
hang on a second, there's an important point here. You actually see Al-Qaeda on the same spectrum as the IRA, do you?
No, I'm not putting it on the same spectrum. I'm talking...
That's exactly what you just said.
No, I didn't. These are two completely distinctive and different sets of political, cultural circumstances. If the first step in our response to the challenge and the terrible problem that we face now is to refuse engagement, the first step in engagement is about understanding. And
so
if
you would
deny
have supported
that,
Chamberlain at Munich. You would have supported Chamberlain at Munich.
The next step in understanding.
Wouldn't you, Ian? You would have supported Chamberlain at Munich.
Of course I wouldn't.
Why not? It's the same argument.
The next step in understanding is not to reduce everything to the Jewish problem. There is more going on in
the
this.
My problem is that the next step in understanding is to address the
problem. Hitler was a conspiracy against the world, the free world. Don't you know that?
My problem, the next step in understanding is then to say we must address the grievances. Well, some of those grievances are not genuine grievances. You can manufacture a whole long list of grievances in order to get young men, headstrong young men, caught up in this jihadist mentality.
Of
course. Doesn't mean that the grievances ought to be addressed.
No, but this is not about addressing grievances. This is about, for example, understanding, as Shiv Malik describes brilliantly in the long piece
that he wrote, the
cultural and intergenerational tensions that are going on in sections of the Asian population in the UK, these demand to be understood and responded to. Not an easy thing to do, but that's what's necessary.
That's where I've got to draw it to a halt. That's it for this week from our panel, Clifford Longley, Melanie Phillips, Ian Hargreaves, Stephen Rose, and from me. Until the same time next week, goodbye.
The Royal Maze was chaired by Michael Burrick and produced by Phil Pegum. In 15 minutes, we place drug-resistant micro-superbugs under the microscope to see why they are fending off the best that modern medicine can throw at them. Now, though, Simon Haggart does his best to ensure the facts do get in the way of a good story as he continues to explode the great political myths.
Welcome back to our look at popular British political myths. This week's selection could be called Here. I never said that. We start with a well-loved political yarn. William Hague once boasted that as a lad he used to guzzle 14 pints of beer every working day. 14 pints? No wonder the media seized on this.
How many pints was it today, Mr. Hague? How many pints did he have?
The story was originally broken by Nicholas Coleridge, who was interviewing Hague for a profile in GQ magazine.
It was quite a long interview, and I have to say that I didn't think I'd really got anything that was substantially new. And then he was talking about how he used to work for his father, who had a brewery, and he used to help his father deliver these big barrels of beer to all the different pubs. And then in his Yorkshire voice, which I don't think I can quite do, he said the good thing was that they gave you always a pint of beer in every pub that you went to. So I said, goodness, so you must have been having about 14 pints a day. And he said, yes, 14 pints a day, that's what I would have had. But of course, you sweat.